Hello, this is Michael Zuber, and I wanted to thank you for choosing to spend a little time with One Rental at a Time. My life's mission is to help investors close 1 million rental properties. In order to tackle this crazy goal, I will need your help. If you like this episode or any of the content we produce, please share it on social media. If you get one of my books or perhaps one of our 500 cards, please take a selfie and tag One Rental at a Time. Now on with the show. Alrighty, folks, we have a treasure. We have a treat for you. We have Jaspreet Singh from Minority Mindset here. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Shout out to Jen for making this happen. Jen reached out to you, coordinated with your staff to make this happen. So, Jen, special shout out to you for doing the work. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Jaspreet.
Yes, exactly. Jaspreet, do me a favor. For the couple of people that don't know who you are in your channel, tell us who you are. Tell us a little bit about your channel and the goals of it.
Yeah, so like you said, my name is Jaspreet Singh. I am a random guy on YouTube. I host a show called The Minority Mindset on YouTube and podcast. And the reason why I call myself a random guy on YouTube is because I literally am a random guy on YouTube. I started making YouTube videos on accident. I never wanted to be a content creator or a YouTuber or whatever they're called. I made videos because I never really had any financial education guidance when I was getting started. And because I got screwed over a lot of times trying to start businesses. So
amen.
I started creating videos as a way for me to just kind of talk about the things I enjoy talking about, because my friends would get really annoyed of me constantly talking about investing and starting a business. So I was like, well, I can talk to a camera and the camera's not going to complain. So that's how it started. And then the channel grew, and now Minority Mindset is approaching 2 million subscribers on YouTube. Nice. And it's still surreal to believe that this random channel, I started making videos off of my cell phone. Like it was very basic. And now here we are.
It's funny. One of the things that I've taken as a focus on recently is trying to get Generation X and baby boomers to realize that all it takes is your phone. In fact, I do a daily show 5 days a week at 7:30 a.m. off my phone on purpose.
That's amazing.
Just for people to realize it's possible.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's one of the biggest, I mean, if we talk about the content game, it can be very easy to be overwhelmed that, oh my God, these people have a $100,000 studio, they have all these lights and these cameras and these mics, but you don't need that to get started. All you need, I mean, if you have a cell phone, that's all you need. When I started, I did not have a microphone. I bought one or two $25 lights off of Amazon. I think I bought one. And about a tripod. So my total investment of like equipment was probably $50.
Exactly. And,
you know, it started. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be great. You're not going to be.
Yeah.
Just get started.
Yeah. Well, you put out a lot of amazing stuff. I've pulled up lots of gems. I hope to get through all of them. But I just want to randomly go through the list that I've created. And one of the things that I actually saw you put on Instagram was this particular trait is the number one thing associated with success. So what is it, and why do you think it is the number one trait associated with success?
Definitely delayed gratification. And I think the reason why is because delayed gratification has so many meanings. Mm. On a financial level, delayed gratification means I know that if I take this $1,000 that I have, and instead of buying a Gucci bag, I put it into my investments and I do this consistently, I'm going to be able to buy a whole lot more nice Gucci stuff without worrying about the price. That's the financial side of delayed gratification. But it's also a mental discipline that comes with it as well. Because delayed gratification also means that I am going to sacrifice my time, and I know that I'm going to put in the sacrifice and the time when it needs to be made. Whether you're starting a business, you're going to start investing in real estate, you want to invest in stocks, you want to do something, it's hard. And it's hard in so many levels. It's hard because number one, you're going to have to sacrifice your time. And in the early stages of becoming an entrepreneur, becoming an investor, it is hard as a time commitment. And there's no way around it. A lot of people on the internet sell this whole idea that, oh, work 4 hours a week and you're going to be able to live on a beach in 6 months. That's a whole bunch of crap.
Absolutely.
It takes a lot of time in the beginning. And that's a sacrifice, because that means you might not get to see your friends on the weekends. You might not be able to enjoy some holidays in the beginning and do all these fun things. But you have to have the delayed gratification to know I'm doing this so I can have longer vacations, have better weekends, have more time in the future.
Yeah.
And then it goes into money. And this is one of those things that you don't understand this until you actually see this. Because I remember when I was in my early 20s, my dream car then was a BMW i8, maybe $130,000. And I remember seeing other dudes on social media posting how I just bought this BMW i8. They're making a few hundred thousand dollars a year, maybe $1 million a year. And they're driving this $130,000 car. Then they post these exotic vacations, sometimes even flying in private jets. And I was like, wow, with $1 million a year, these guys are living life, I mean, having everything that you can imagine. And then when my business grew to $1 million a year, I realized, okay, I could take this $1 million and buy myself a fancy car, a bunch of exotic vacations, and have no cash in the bank, or I could take this money and throw it right back into the business. Mm-hmm. That way we can build a bigger asset. And that is another level of delayed gratification that becomes very difficult to understand and experience until you start to grow. And it's like next level, right? Delayed gratification mm-hmm. has steps, it has layers. But that's where it really just depends now on what your goals are. And that delayed gratification, if you look at any successful entrepreneur, any successful person, they all, every single one, 100% of them, have this element of, I know that there's a bigger and better tomorrow, and I'm going to be investing towards that. It doesn't mean that you never get to enjoy money or get to enjoy things. But as the pie gets bigger, a small slice is a lot of dollars. Like, 5% of $1 million is a lot more than 5% of $100,000. And as you grow, 5% of 10 million is a whole lot bigger too. So as you grow, right, you can still take out small pieces, but the small pieces are big dollar amounts.
Yeah. I love this concept. I agree with you. Delayed gratification is the thing. And when people on my channel, they know that Olivia and I chose to delay for 15 years. It just kept stacking and stacking and stacking. And now if they see what we're doing, it's like, you know, I wish I could be them. And I'm like, nobody wanted to be us for 15 years. We didn't buy a bigger house. We had one car. We didn't take vacations. We kept earning money, buying assets, you know, and repeating for 15 years. Our friends made fun of us, Jaspreet. They made fun of us. They talked behind our back. Like, oh, I can't, like, they, like my guy friends. Oh, I can't believe he doesn't let his wife do this or that. I'm like, felt miserable in the moment, but it's fun to look back now.
I call this the decade of sacrifice, that you have to be willing to go through a decade or more of being willing to spend less and earn more so you can invest like crazy. And there's, I mean, if you really want to have what you call freedom, that financial freedom, there's no way around it. Like, you can buy whatever guru coach, whatever you want. My words got jumbled up, but you can spend whatever amount of money trying to learn the secrets. But until you're willing to put in the sacrifice, you're never going to get what you want to get. Now, I'm not against buying education. I think education is great. I think you have to have the right education. I think there's a lot of good online education, but the education without the work is not going to do any good.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, right? I sell a course for $400, even though, you know, all the gurus say it should be 1,000, because I want there to be an entry level. I'm not here to maximize the income, right? But I tell people all the time, if you're just going to buy the $400 course and not take it, keep your money. I don't need it. Right. Because I can watch it. I can look at the course and go, you bought it 3 weeks ago and you've watched 8 minutes of it. Why are we doing that? Why are we doing that? So it's pretty fun to think about. Another thing that you said that I loved is get paid, buy assets, repeat. Is it just that simple?
You know, if I look back and see what was the big change in my own life, and I can only speak for myself. Before I started making money when I was in college, because I always had this entrepreneurial mind, and I got into party planning, which became an event planning company. It actually started in high school, but it really started to take off my freshman, sophomore year, junior year in college. And prior to, I read a book by Dave Ramsey called Total Money Makeover.
Yeah.
But prior to that, I made money and I upgraded my car and I bought these studded out nice watches.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and I was spending, and if I made $1,000, I spent $1,000. Like, that was the way that I did, because I was like, I'm young. What do I need savings for? Mm-hmm. And I'm making money. And if you're in the party, like I was working at clubs. I didn't drink. I wasn't into partying, but that was my business. So I was like, I got to look the part. And I read this book. I also read Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. And again, I was so naive. I didn't know what an investment was. I didn't know what a dividend was. I never heard the term asset before. I don't know what real estate investing was. Nobody in my family was a real estate investor. So these are like foreign concepts to me. And I'm reading these books and I was like, you're telling me if I take this money and instead of me putting it in new rims for my car, I could go out and buy this thing, this asset, and I can get paid for it. Like, it was so shocking to me that I went from one polar extreme of spending everything that I made to now I'm not spending a penny.
Wow.
I'm going to buy as many investments as possible. I bought my first rental property when I was 19, between my sophomore and junior year in college. And
very nice.
You know, you talk about, is it as simple as making money and buying assets? I mean, if you look at it from a math perspective, yes. From a psychological perspective, it's a lot harder done than actually just saying it, because this meant that when everybody, I went to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, huge football school. I played football in high school. I'm a big football guy. I went to one quarter of one game my entire college career because I was working on Saturdays. I didn't get to go out and party on Fridays because I was hosting the parties. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to do that, you know, some of the things that people would consider that normal college experience, because there were things that I was prioritizing.
Yeah.
And for me, that was making money so that way I could buy assets. Now, buying assets is also its own. It's not as easy as people make it sound, because your first investment, whether it's stocks, real estate, your own business, is hard. My first rental property, I got sued. I was like 20 years old. I got sued by the first tenant. I'm in college and I get served with my first lawsuit and I don't know what to do. What I mean? Like it's the tenant said that the bathtub was too slippery when the water was on.
Mm.
And so now here I am 20 or 21 or something like that years old. And I'm trying to figure out how I can make some extra money, and I'm trying to manage these things. But it's how you learn. And during that time, it is very stressful, because I like, oh my God, like, am I going to be able to actually see more success in here? Is my career over in real estate? Am I a horrible person? And you got to go through these hurdles. And what somebody told me that kind of really helped me during that time was, if you haven't been sued yet, you haven't been in business long enough.
If it's coming. Yeah.
It's coming. And, you know, especially in America, because I'm a licensed attorney now. Yeah. Anybody can sue anybody for anything, which is, I guess, besides the point. But ultimately, you know, from a math perspective, yeah, you make money, you buy investments. But from a psychological perspective, there's a lot of work that's required to actually do that and succeed with that, because that means you got to keep investing when the markets are up and when the markets are down, and be willing to stay disciplined to keep doing that. Because,
yeah,
well, we've seen over the last decade and a half, markets go up and markets go down and markets go sideways. And it takes a lot of emotion to be able to understand how do you navigate these waters.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to talk about that I think it's important and very few people talk about is discretionary income. A lot of people talk about, hey, I make six figures a year. Some people talk about I net 80 grand a year. But I believe this whole magic, this whole buy, get paid, buy assets, repeat, it's all about discretionary income. And now it obviously goes back to point number one, delayed gratification. But at the end of the day, for me, it was about how do I increase that number, right? You can cut expenses, raise income, or do both. So what do you think about focusing on discretionary income?
Yeah. So the way that I look at it, the way that I talk about it is, I say wealth is divided up in three phases. In phase one, this is where now you are trying to lay your foundation, meaning you're trying to save your first $2,000 and you're trying to get out of credit card debt if you have other high interest debts. If you are in phase one, meaning you don't have a couple grand saved up, or if you have credit card or other high interest debts, you don't have discretionary income. No. Right now, you got to save your first $2,000. You got to pay down the high interest debts, period. Phase number two, this is where now you're getting to the next level of wealth, where you're building a financial system. You're starting to invest some money. You're starting to build some savings. So I like to talk about a 75-15-10 plan, which says that for every dollar that you earn, 75 cents is the maximum that you can spend. 15 cents is the minimum you're investing. 10 cents is the minimum that you're saving.
I like
so now what you're doing is, no matter how much money you earn, whether it's $200 a month or $200,000 a month, some of your money is going to be saved, invested, and spent. The more money you make, the more money you have to spend. But during this phase, I'm still, one of the things I talk about is, you don't, just because you have $100 to spend, doesn't mean you want to go out and spend $100 on a pair of shoes. You want to be smart here, especially if it's things that you don't necessarily need to survive. Those, what I call luxuries or quote unquote dumb purchases. I'm not against dumb purchases. I just want you to afford the dumb purchases. So during this phase two, one of the things that I follow is a rule of five. If you can't buy five of them, can't afford one of them.
There you go.
So if I'm going to use my hard-earned money, I'm working in my business and I'm getting paid. If I'm going to use my money to buy Rolex, that's $10,000. I better have $50,000 to buy that Rolex, because I want to make sure that I have this cushion. I'm not spending all my money to buy something that's not adding anything to my life.
Yeah, phase three, you're not going to zero.
Right. Phase three now is the wealth phase. And this is where now you've invested your money. I like investing for cash flow, rental properties, dividends. Most of my investments are that way. Now, as I make cash flow from my investments, especially after your cash flow exceeds your expenses, but once you make cash flow from your investments, if you're going to use this cash flow to buy something, buy whatever you want. Now you can afford it, because that money is going to keep coming back. So if you want to go buy that $10,000 Rolex and you got $10,000 coming in from your rental properties, your dividends, or whatever, your cash flow, go ahead and buy it. It's money you didn't have to work hard to earn. You worked hard to buy the asset, but now the asset keeps paying you.
Yeah.
So, you know, discretionary income is great. Everyone's working hard to make money. But you have to be strategic with now how you're spending it, because a lot of people are like, oh, I made a $5,000 bonus. Let me go celebrate.
I deserve it. Yeah.
And sure, I mean, that's fine. But at the end of the day, you got to decide, is this the right time for you to do that?
Yeah.
What is the right priority for you?
Yeah. What season are you in?
Exactly. You get what you prioritize. You don't get what you want.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Another topic you've put out there is winning in a recession. Something I've said over the years is, I hope you live through five or six recessions, because they are a natural part of the business cycle. I know going through your first one, scary.
Yeah.
Going through your second one, you kind of built up a callus. By the time you're going through your third one, you're like, I'm excited, because that's when assets go on sale. So why don't you talk about winning in a recession?
Yeah, so we actually did a deep dive of this in Market Briefs by a financial newsletter. And the interesting thing about a recession is, recessions create more millionaires than any other time.
Exactly.
And the reason why is because it's almost like Black Friday for investors. See, when Best Buy offers a sale on TVs, what happens? You see a line around the door of people saying, I'm ready to pay 50% off for my Sony 85-inch TV. But when asset prices fall, that creates a different type of panic and fear, which, you know, it's normal. When you see stock prices falling, people are worried that the economy is going to end, that the whole system is going to implode, that everything is done for. And this is not a new phenomenon. Like, this, that didn't just happen in 2020. That didn't just happen in 2008. It also happened in 2000 and happened multiple times before that. It's funny, if you go read, I like reading, not reading books, but I listen to Audible. And when you read books of like biographies of people like successful investors, if you read about Warren Buffett's books, or if you read other books like that, what's interesting is they don't specifically talk about what happened in these recessions, but they'll talk about how their emotions were when you had the oil crisis happen, or when other recessions happen. And it's the same thing that happens time and time again, that I call it poop, P-O-O-P. Panic leads to overselling, leads to opportunity, leads to profit. And it's crazy, because when I started investing in real estate during the 2008 crash, I bought my first property in 2011. I was very fortunate about the timing. I didn't know what was going on, but I was fortunate that this was like, real estate prices are very low. But when I started buying real estate, I remember trying to tell my friends, I'm like, dude, you have money. Your parents have money. You should go do this real estate thing, or talking to other people that I knew who had money. But the common consensus was, no, Real estate investing is risky. No one's going to want to own a home anymore. Everybody who touches real estate is getting burned. Don't be stupid and go out and buy real estate. I mean, it's looking back, it's like, no way. But there's a reason why people who were very smart with money were not buying real estate during that time. There was a lot of panic.
Yeah.
But the panic created overselling. Now, part of their overselling was foreclosures, but also people were selling because they were scared. That created opportunity. Now, that opportunity took time before the profit really started to go up a lot. I mean, it took years before real estate prices went back to normal and all of that. But it's a risk, but it created opportunity for the right person. Likewise, when the 2020 pandemic happened, I talked about this. So this was actually where I started Market Briefs, because when the 2020 pandemic hit, prior to the pandemic, I was making a few videos a week. Pandemic hits, now I'm making 7 videos a week because the whole economy got flipped upside down.
It did.
And I needed a way to stay up to date on what was happening in the news, the financial news. So I asked my team, can you give me a daily briefing of what's happening in the news? And so I started using this briefing to kind of come up with topics for was to cover things on my YouTube channel, Minority Mindset. Well, then I started sprinkling this newsletter on my YouTube channel, Market Briefs, and then that became Market Briefs today. But the interesting thing about the 2020 pandemic was this was the first time that I was involved in the content space. And so I talked about in March and April 2020, stock prices are crashing. I'm buying in phases on the way down. As it goes down further, I am buying more aggressively. And I would receive floods of comments of people saying, Jaspreet, have you lost your mind?
Yeah.
The whole economy is about to like collapse. Our country's done for. The system is going to fail. It's all done. And my response was, well, if things are done, money in the bank's not going to do any good anyways.
Anyway.
Right? So either things are going to completely be done and we're all done, or things are going to recover and the stock market's going to go up. Now, I work in the financial media, financial news space, and I have been investing for a while now. But I have never expected the Federal Reserve Bank to print money the way that they did in 2020 to turn around the stock market the way that they did. But we saw how fast the stock market turned around. So, I mean, we know for a fact, booms and busts are a part of our economic system. The economy goes up and it goes down. For the last century, we've seen a recession pretty much every decade for the last century. So now, the fact of the matter is, this is a part of our economic system. Don't be one of the people that gets blindsided by it. Be one of the people that understands it, that we can take advantage of the way that our system works. It makes people angry, but the reality is, gravity is there. You can either fight gravity or learn how to harness gravity. And just like that, recessions are there. You can either try to fight it and say this is bad and evil, or try to harness it and understand how you can win in this economic system.
Yeah.
And this is where now that financial education comes into play, because every successful investor understands the way the economic system works. And they know recessions are going to happen. I don't know when it's going to happen. Nobody knows if it's going to happen next month, next year, or 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
Right.
But they're ready for them. And that means when things go wrong, they have the opportunity to go out and buy investments at a discounted price.
Yeah. The next thing I want to talk about, you kind of hinted it there. You know, you really start creating daily content during the 2020s. You have Market Briefs. I would argue that your content is very focused on education and taking advantage of opportunity. You happen to operate in a space which is also dominated by what I call crash bros and doom porn, who seem to grow very quickly, have a very loyal following. And I'm sure, I mean, they come to my channel, so they have to come to yours and just blow up the comment section with negativity. So what do you think about doom porn? Why didn't you go that direction? And how do you deal with all these negative fools?
Well, just don't really pay attention to a lot of the negativity. You know, the internet is a place where people love to hate, unfortunately. And people will hate you for anything. I talk about guacamole. People hate guacamole, so they hate me. People hate me for the way that I look, the way that I sound. I mean, they'll hate you for anything that you can imagine or not even imagine. And so, I mean, you can't, I try just to ignore that part. And honestly, I feel kind of bad because I have a lot of free content online. And how much, like, what does somebody have to be going through to be so miserable to then leave essays or, send emails talking about how you're this evil person for talking about financial education for free on YouTube and whatnot. So, I mean, it's a part of the game, and it's not going to change what I do. But what I think, in regards to what you're saying, regarding doom porn or other things like that, the difficult part here is YouTube is a search engine, and it has certain algorithms. And at the end of the day, let's say you're talking about how to invest in stocks. If you have one video titled "Three Things You Should Know When You Invest in Stocks," or "The Best Stock Market Opportunity in the World Is Here, How to Invest," one of these videos are going to get more clicks. And unfortunately, in this day and age, if you don't have an attractive title or video, it is going to be hard to generate the clicks, which then ultimately means your video may end up in the YouTube graveyard. Not guaranteed, but it may. And so this is where we had to find the right balance for us, because I hated those types of titles and thumbnails. But at the end of the day, you also want people to watch your education. So I'm not, I guess, completely oblivious to that. So sometimes, we have to make titles that are, we'll call them clickbait. They're more attractive. But the goal with us is that, because of the sell with my team was, you have good value in your videos, and if you want people to watch them, you have to make sure people can actually click it, but then make sure that the value is there inside of the video. But this was a big motivation for me. I talked about market briefs, to build and grow market briefs, because market briefs is a daily financial newsletter that breaks down what's happening in the financial markets. And because it's a newsletter that has all the content there, we don't need any of the sensationalism. Like, you open the newsletter and all the content's there. So now you have your real estate housing market news, you have the stock market news, you have the economic news, you have the global economy news, you have the crypto news. And we don't have to sit here and try to sell you to check the news. We have people that are reading. Even if we didn't have a subject line, we know people are going to read the newsletter because they've fallen in love with it. So that was a big, 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 big reason for me to push market briefs, was because it gives me the opportunity now to educate what's happening in the news without having to go down the extreme sensationalist route,
I
but then
love that.
also provide education in my own ways through our own academy and then through the YouTube channel.
I think Market Briefs, the newsletter, is a genius way to kind of split the difference. Stay true to yourself. You can use YouTube, the thumbnails and titles to get the clicks. But when somebody loves what Jaspreet and the team are doing, they get Market Briefs, and it's just who you are, right? It's just there. I think that's genius. One of your most recent videos talked about BlackRock CEO Larry Fink giving a retirement warning. According to BBC, 75 is the new 65. What do you think of all that?
Well, what do I think? I think that if you're an American, you need to start planning for your own retirement so you don't have to rely on BlackRock and the government to take care of you. Because the reason why this article gained so much publicity, where essentially what he said was Americans need to work longer. And the reason why is because people are living longer, they're pulling more money out of Social Security, and Social Security is drying up. That was the essence of what was said. Now, from a math perspective, you can see where that makes sense, because if people are paying into Social Security is mismanaged. There's not enough money going around. If you're under the age of 45, the money you're putting into Social Security today is not going to fund your retirement. It's going to fund somebody else's retirement. And if you look at, I showed the chart of Social Security assets. Over the last couple of years, Social Security assets have been falling instead of rising, which means they're paying out more money than they're bringing in. So, the big thing here is, well, if you want to keep a line on the government to retire, you're going to need to work longer. So you might have to work till 70 or 75 years old, which makes a lot of people upset. Naturally, I worked so hard. I want to be able to enjoy my life at 65. Okay. But here's the caveat. And here's the point that I try to get across. You can do it at 55. You can do it at 45. Once you have the assets, you can do it whenever you want, because now you don't have to rely on the government to fund your retirement. You don't have to rely on BlackRock to tell you when you can retire, because what BlackRock was also pitching was their own retirement account, target date retirement account, where you want to retire by 67, you invest your money into this account, and then they will give you your money, and then they'll also decide how much money you can pull out every year. I don't want anybody to tell me how much money I can pull out. Exactly. I want to be in control of that.
Yeah.
And if I want to have more money, I want to, this is where you got to plan now. And so, you know, my thoughts are, this is why, this is 100% why your financial education is so important. Because if you're in your 40s, your 30s, your 20s, your teens, even in your 50s, I mean, there are things you can do right now to change, which will allow you to live the rest of your life better financially because of what you did in your earlier years. There's a book I'm reading right now called Outlive by Peter Attia. I think that's the name. But what he talks about is a very similar concept, but in the health space, where as you get older, people start worrying about heart attacks and cancer and diabetes and these types of things. And medical doctors will start treating you after you have health risks, right? After you start showing high blood pressure, after you start having high sugar. But what he says is, look, that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, this takes years, if not decades, to build up. So if you want to live healthier longer,
right,
it's what you do in your 40s, 30s, and 20s to start setting up for a healthier 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's the exact same thing with your money. You want to have more financial freedom in your 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond? You got to be smarter in your 40s, 30s, and 20s to set up for that freedom. And that was ultimately what I got, is this is why your financial education is important.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm trying to get people to think about is that early retirement is possible. It's shocking to me how many people don't think it's possible. You and I have talked about it taking roughly a decade. That doesn't really matter to me if you're 25 or 35 or 45. It's roughly a decade. So would you agree that early retirement is not only possible, but, you know, probable if you do the right things for a decade?
It starts with a decade. It might take longer, right. But it's an extreme sacrifice during that decade. And then it's knowing what you want to have in retirement, because I think the misconception a lot of people have is, I'm going to put aside $300,000 over the next decade, and then I expect to fly first class and
yeah,
travel the world and do all these things. So it's you have to know what you want. I mean, could you retire for $300,000? Sure. I mean, you could move to Guatemala and live like a king.
Maybe, yeah,
but
exactly.
You got to know what it is that you want and understand the cost of what it is that you want and understand, are you putting in the work to get what you want? And there's nothing wrong, like, there's nothing wrong with flying first class. There's nothing wrong with wanting the nice things. There's nothing wrong with wanting to fly in a private jet. But you got to make sure your goals are aligning with your actions and just understanding what's right for you. And on the concept of retirement, I mean, also understanding, what does retirement look like for you? Because I don't want you to be 38 years old, have a lot of cash in the bank, and then now you sit there and you watch TV for 10 hours a day.
Ugh.
You now become a miserable person, but understanding you have the freedom to do what you want and being able to express that freedom, because you want to be able to live a fulfilling life. This is where I talk about, you want to be physically fit, mentally fit, spiritually fit, and financially fit. You can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have a sense of purpose, it doesn't do you any good. And you have to have the purpose if you really want to live a fulfilling life.
Yeah.
And you have to think about that too.
I agree with that. You got to have something. You got to feel like you're contributing. You can't just sit on the couch at 38 and watch TV. That's a miserable existence. Absolutely. Your most popular video, I don't know if you know this, apparently it has 3.2 million views, I think I wrote down, is, if you have $1,000 in the bank, do these five things. Want to kind of talk about those five things, or maybe twist them up a little bit now that it's been a couple of years?
Yeah, you know, in that video, what I go over and what is very important is, if you have $1,000, what you do with it is going to depend, again, on what you want to do. Because what a lot of people assume is, if I have $1,000, I can buy $1,000 watch. I can do these things, which, sure, but that is going to change the trajectory of your wealth. And so if it's your first $1,000, What you got to do is you got to save it. If you have no savings, you have no cash in the bank, you don't do anything except just put that money away and don't touch it.
Right.
If you have credit card debt, you take the $1,000 and you attack the credit card debt. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have some savings, you have no credit card debt, and now you're like, I have $1,000 to invest. Now, what do I do with this $1,000, Jaspreet? Well, now you can take this $1,000 and you can do a few things. But the question is, what do you want this $1,000 to do? Do you want this $1,000 to give you 5, 6, 7% return a year? Or do you want to turn this $1,000 into $10,000 or $100,000? And so now the question is, well, if you want to turn this $1,000 into $100,000, you don't want to go put this money into a low-cost ETF or an index fund, because that's going to take forever to see that growth.
Right.
That means you got to take this $1,000 and invest it into you, into a business idea.
Mm.
And maybe that means now you buy books. Maybe that means you buy a course. Maybe that means you invest into an LLC. Maybe that means you invest into getting products for your business idea. But I'm going to put that $1,000 into use into a way that's going to give you the most upside. Like, I started the Minority Mindset brand with under $1,000, under $500.
Wow.
Which then spun off into the Minority Mindset, which also then created Briefs Media. But I mean, from a cash investment, it wasn't that much because, I told you, I was making videos off of my cell phone. I bought a light and a tripod, and then I just started publishing videos. Like, I didn't have any fancy editing software or really anything. But then as we made more money, I reinvested money back into the business. Likewise, if you want to start a business and you want to be able to turn your $1,000 into something a whole lot bigger, you're going to have to invest that money into you, whether it's education, whether it's into your own brand or some other thing like that. If now you say, just put to have a good job, I have my savings, I have no credit card debt, but I want to start investing my money and I want to just have some money working for me on the side. Okay, great. Well, if you don't want to start a business, that's completely fine. You don't have to. Then the question is, well, how do you want to invest this money? You want to invest this money into stocks? Because $1,000 into real estate is going to be very difficult unless you're investing into somebody else's fund. And that's where you decide now, well, what is it that you want to invest in? If you want to invest in stocks, do you want to invest in ETFs or index funds or mutual funds, or would you rather invest into individual companies? And they both have different types of risk, different types of reward, different types of work required. And so I go over all of those things. Likewise, if you want to invest in real estate, well, there are ways for you to invest in other people's funds, but you don't have the same control, you don't have the same ownership, you don't have the same tax benefits. So it's just understanding now what it is that you want and then knowing where you are. And as you go through these steps of wealth, as you generate more money, you understand how to invest that money. Because a big problem, I think a big confusion that a lot of people have, is if I take this $1,000 and I invest it, I don't got to do it again. Like, I'm done with the investing. I put $1,000 into it. Now my investments are secure. But that's not how it works. You got to keep continually investing if you want to build wealth. And really, I mean, that's where it ultimately comes down to. Just keep continuously
keep going.
Investing. For a decade or more.
There you go.
Start to see that upside.
Well, that probably goes right into the next thing I wrote down. You have a saying that saving won't make you rich.
Yes. Well, your savings are there to protect you against an emergency. Your investments are there to make you wealthy.
Yeah, downside protection.
Yes. I have savings, but I don't use my savings to quote unquote retire. That's not going to build me a new wealth. I have savings for my own business. Like, we have our own cash savings in case, you know, money stops coming in tomorrow. Well, we don't have to lay anybody off because we have cash savings. We can continue paying our rent. We can continue our operations because we have cash savings. On my personal account, it's the same thing. If my business went bankrupt tomorrow, my wife and I can continue paying our expenses and living our life because we have cash savings. That's what those savings are for. But then I also have some savings that, if we went into a recession tomorrow and markets crashed, I have some money now to go out and attack and buy when things are discounted. But I also know that the savings, I mean, they're being eaten away by inflation. The reported inflation numbers are something around 3%. Now, the average person is experiencing higher inflation than 3%. I mean, it's funny because I did a video on this recently, which said that between 2020 and 2024, I think it was February 2024, the price of groceries went up about 22%, meaning if you bought $100 groceries in 2020, that same $100 groceries in 2024 would cost you $122.
I saw
now,
that. Yep.
I don't know, because for me, that $100 groceries cost a whole lot more than 122 bucks today.
Me
but
too.
Maybe I'm shopping in the wrong places. I don't know. But the average person, I think, is feeling higher than 3% inflation. But regardless, your savings are sitting there generally not growing. Now, I have high interest savings accounts. They're paying around 4 or 5% today, which is higher than reported inflation. But again, it's just kind of like a wash. Like, that interest is not making me richer. It's just kind of there to combat inflation. But my investments, I invest my money in five places. I have my own business. I invest my money into real estate, into stocks, into my speculative investments, and then physical gold. So my speculative investments are like the startups that I invest in. I have some cryptocurrency investments. It's a small piece of a portfolio, but the speculative is kind of fun. But now these investments are what make me wealthy. Like, this is where now I know my investments are what is going to make me wealthy. My savings are there just to protect me against downside. And I grew up, and I'm sure a lot of people did, being told that if you have a lot of cash in the bank, you're going to be rich. That just keeps saving, 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 and that's how you become rich. But it doesn't work in today's economy. Maybe it worked 50 years ago, but it doesn't work today. If you want to become wealthy, you can't just do that by saving. You need to have savings to protect you, but you have to have investments if you want to become wealthy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your fifth one. You talked about physical gold. Gold has been doing pretty interesting things the last 30 days or so, kind of up every day. Is this a sign, you think, of stress in the system? Is this just national banks, federal banks buying gold because something's coming? Is Peter Schiff finally right? Gold's going to have its time in the sun. What's going on?
Well, let me premise it with my thoughts.
Sure.
Because I've been buying gold for years. This isn't something I started doing in the last couple of years. I've been buying gold for years. And for me, the way I look at buying gold is not an investment. For me, gold is a way for me to save hard money. It's an alternative form of savings. So I honestly don't really monitor the price of gold. I see all the news, gold prices hitting record highs, blah, blah, blah. But to me, gold is not an investment. And the reason why is because it doesn't do anything. Like, an investment to me is something that provides value. When I buy a rental property in a growing area, it provides value because somebody can live there and they can use this property and it's going to provide cash flow. If I buy stocks, if I go out and buy stock in the Amazon company, Amazon is working to provide value. They're working to create an e-commerce platform to help with the AWS, to help with a lot of different things. So they're working to provide value. When I buy physical gold, it sits there in a vault and it does nothing.
Yeah, it's just store value. There.
And so for me, when I buy gold, that's all it is. It's just a way, alternative form of savings. Now, why are people buying gold? Well, I think people are naturally nervous. I think people are nervous about risks of inflation being around longer than expected. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Chase Bank, recently just released his letter to shareholders.
I saw that.
And what he said was essentially that inflation risks are probably higher than what most people expect. And the chances of soft landing, according to him, are also higher or lower than what people expect. Most people are expecting a soft landing. He says that we might not get what a lot of people are expecting. So, I mean, you have some people that are naturally nervous. People are nervous about ongoing. I mean, we're still running a very large government deficit. That's not going away. So I think for those reasons, people are turning to gold. And then you have a lot of geopolitical issues. Like, you have the BRICS nations. That are working to create new currencies that are based off of gold and other reserve currencies around the world that are trying to now back away from the dollar. So there's a lot of, I guess, concerns, which is not new, but I think because of that, people are wondering what is the alternative, because if something bad does happen, how do you protect yourself? And we know that gold has been a hedge for
historically a great store of value in times of chaos.
And so I think for that reason, people are buying it, but I don't like it. I don't want to buy it because I think it's going to go up to double the price and I'm going to be able to sell it for a profit. That's not my intention with gold. For me, it's just, I'm just going to keep growing and stacking it, and it's there for doomsday insurance.
There you go. I like it. I like it. There's a saying that I put out on my channel the last year or so. I'm going to share it with you and just see how it lands. See if it feels misguided, off, whatever. You ready?
Yep.
Inflation is a feature, not a bug.
It's a feature, not a bug. Explain that to me. I want to make sure I'm on the right page.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people look at inflation, like we saw inflation spike during the pandemic to 9.1%, if you believe what CPI has. And then we have a lot of people just, you know, inflation is bad, right? Inflation is evil. It's something to be corrected. But if you look at what the Fed has told us for years, their target is, it's always been 2%. Mm-hmm. Now, 9% is obviously a problem, but they've always had 2% as the goal. If you know our deficits, one of the things, the reasons the deficit is supposed to get better is you're paying it off with dollars that are depreciated.
Right.
And the real goal, or at least when you think about real estate investing, is one of the benefits we have in the United States is 30-year fixed rate debt. We don't have ARMs. We don't have five-year resets. So if you think inflation is a feature, meaning it's built into the system, and you have a way to get levered 30-year debt at fixed rate, you can invest and let inflation be your friend, i.e. the values of the properties go up because of inflation. Rents go up because of inflation. And oh, by the way, debt stay fixed. So that's one of the things that I think inflation's a feature and it's not a bug.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. The way that I talk about it is that inflation disproportionately benefits the financially educated and it disproportionately hurts the financially uneducated. And the reason why is because when I teach what is inflation, without getting into what inflation is, but let's talk about what inflation does. Inflation means that consumers have to pay more money. So when you go to Walmart, when you go to Whole Foods, you buy something, you pay more money. Who does that hurt? It's everybody. Rich people, middle-class people, poor people.
Everybody.
Everybody's going to eat. So everybody gets hurt. Mm-hmm. But it also benefits some people. Who does it benefit? It benefits the asset owners. If you are an investor in the Walmart company, and Walmart is sending their stuff for more money, and now they're showing higher revenues. Now, you as the investor are benefiting. When you own the property that Walmart's sitting on, and now Walmart has to pay you higher rents, or your property value goes up, you're also benefiting as the investor. So everybody is hurt by inflation. All Great. Consumers, because everybody's a consumer, is going to have to pay more stuff for more money. But the financially educated also benefit from inflation, because now you own the asset that's charging more money and you own the asset that's worth more. And that's why financial education is so important. And unfortunately, inflation, like what you said, it's been around for a long time. I mean, we had an inflation crisis in the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it tamed out between the 80s and the 2020 pandemic. But it wasn't gone. Like
it wasn't zero.
And so when the Fed says they want 2% inflation, the question is, why? Why not 0%? And what you said is 100% right, because the government is going to continue to print money. They're going to continue to rack up this national debt, and they want to be able to pay it off with cheaper dollars in the future. Well, another thing you want to understand about 2% is 2% is also just low enough that the average person doesn't mm-hmm. see it day by day. So now when your groceries go from $100 to $103, $105, no big deal, right? You say $102, which is what it should be, but yeah, it's going to be a little bit more.
Okay.
But you don't really notice that, right? Like it's not a big deal for the average person.
Right.
But when it goes up from 100 to 170, now people notice. And that's where people start to get concerned. What is inflation? What is going on? And the funny thing is, before the pandemic, I used to do this thing where I would travel to different parts of the country and talk to people on the streets and ask them basic questions about money. And one of the questions I would ask, this is like 2018, 2019, what is inflation? And I would get the most ridiculous answers, where people would say inflation is when my tire goes flat, or inflation is other things that have nothing to do with money. And I published these videos on YouTube. People thought they were hilarious. And they would say, Jaspreet, how many people did you have to talk to find these types of answers? Thinking that I'm trying to go out of my way to find comedic
You're answers. Seeking the funny ones, yeah.
But that's not my business, right? I'm not a content creator in that sense. Like I did not. Like I would just talk to people and I published the answers. These were the answers that I got. Like this was the common consensus, especially before the pandemic, that most people had absolutely no idea what inflation was. I even talked to it was unfortunate, but it was this lady who had just graduated, I think it was her master's in economics, who couldn't explain. And she was like still in her graduation gown, who couldn't explain what inflation was. And this is the reality. Like now people are becoming a little bit more educated to inflation, at least that inflation hurts me when it comes to spending.
Right.
But what a lot of people don't understand is how do I benefit from inflation? Because every single wealthy person knows, and they're telling their kids how to take advantage of it. But unfortunately, the average person never learns unless you go out of your way to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that you've said that I wrote down is you need to work to own assets, not flip them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a trader. I'm not a flipper. I tried trading stocks when I was in college because everybody on the internet was like, this is how you make money, trade stocks. Oh, man, that was a
miserable.
Yeah. So it's not for me. I work to own and stack assets. And part of the reason that I like saying what you said is because I like to make my money from cash flow versus right. I think the average person is working to invest money so you can build a big nest egg. So you can start selling it off in the future, which you know, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. It doesn't work for me because I don't like the idea of having to sell. I'll give you a quick example of this. I started buying Bitcoin years ago, like before it was $10,000 or even $20,000 a coin. I was buying it earlier. Then it runs up to 70 some thousand dollars a coin. And I was like, okay, well, I've owned this for some while. Let me sell some of this now. If I sell it, I lose any potential upside, but I get that big check today. So there's always going to be that risk versus with the rental property. If it goes up in value, that also means I get to generate more rent generally. And so now I get to reap the rewards today without having to sell it. Now, crypto for me is a very small piece of my portfolio, but with real estate, with cash flow, I can just stack the cash flow, buy more assets, and just keep stacking, stacking, stacking.
Yeah, and the other beauty about real estate, I suppose you can do this with Bitcoin, I don't know. But at some point, you could go back and do a cash out refi. And what happens when you borrow money on your real estate? Is that taxed?
No.
Not taxed. Non-taxable event. That's not taxable. Yeah, so there's a lot of upsides. Again, the whole key for me to getting rich is first 5 years suck. It's really slow. It's really painful. A lot of pain. Takes a decade, maybe a little bit more, but it's so worth it. It's a small season of your life. And the upside is there. I guess the last thing I want to talk about, Jaspreet, is this notion I see all over the internet, all over social media that says millionaires have seven streams of income. And that annoys me. But before leading the witness, I'm curious. Seven streams of income, millionaires, that's how to do it?
You got to start with one.
Exactly.
I think the part that people miss on that statement is they become a millionaire because they have
one,
and then
when
they
go this way.
Yeah, see, so you start like you make a million, and then you start doing the second, and then you can do the third, because when you try to do everything, your time gets diluted, and your money.
You don't learn. You don't get that scale, that repetition.
Yeah, and so you have to build something, or create something, or have that income, and once you have that. Now you have the ability to do a second thing because now you don't have to put all your time into it. You can hire somebody else to do it. And now you can just fund it and let that thing grow with your knowledge and expertise. And you just kind of guide it. Once you do the second, you can do the same with the third and the fourth. So it becomes easier that way. But you have to kind of really build one thing first before you spend all your time doing a bunch of things.
I agree. Well, let's close it on this topic. I do talk about real estate a lot. Everybody's talking housing crash. You have any thoughts on the housing market, over the next couple of years?
Well, if you're buying a home, just make sure you can afford it. It means you can afford the down payment, you can afford the monthly payment, and you can afford the move-in costs. You have to be able to afford the cost to live in this home. In terms of a potential housing market crash, I think there's a lot of risks to our economy. I don't think we have the same 2008 style housing market risks, but the risk today is that risks in the economy could hurt the housing market.
Sure.
But also understanding that home prices move so much slower than stock prices. The 2008 crash started in 2008. Housing prices didn't bottom until 2012.
Yeah, it's a lot slower.
And yeah. By 2012, the stock market had already fully rebounded. So understanding that, you know, if you're waiting for a housing market crash, it can take a long time because people are much more likely to raise the price of their homes and offer a higher price and take the higher price versus cut the prices of their homes. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, do we have risks? 100%. We've seen some neighborhoods around the country like Austin,
mm-hmm.
see home prices get hurt.
Sure.
But understanding now the big risk factor in the housing market today is what's going on in the economy and inflation. If we continue to see more pain there, that could definitely trickle into the housing market because people just can't afford to buy more homes and that could trickle down. But you know, don't make your life decisions based off of a potential crash unless you are a professional at what you're doing.
There you go. Well, Jaspreet, I've had a great time. You've got a lot of great stuff on Minority Mindset. Where can we get more information on Market Briefs?
Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. You can check on Market Briefs by going to Google, searching Market Briefs, or you can go to briefs.co/market. That's briefs.co/market to see more about Market Briefs and to join that. Or you can check out Minority Mindset on YouTube and everywhere else on the internet.
There you go. Thank you, Jaspreet. You're amazing.
Hey, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.